Oh, you thought you had a meeting?
So, forgive us for starting 10 minutes late. And forgive us for bringing you here at 8:30 instead of 9 o'clock. The committee's take on the matter. We should elaborate briefly last week to give you a sense of the areas on which the Honourable Prince should prepare himself on. Those areas were particularly around the memorandum as well as the object of the law. So at least that meeting assisted us because it sent signals that the committee would concentrate largely on the memorandum as well as the objects of the law to determine finally what would they say on the proposal. But if the committee allows me, I will also indicate to the Honourable Prince that the first thing that the committee noted and appreciated was the fact that the exercise, the bill, the Honourable Prince Buthelezi wants to restore dignity of the office of the President. They accepted that. However, from the arguments flowed, which I'm sure we will summarize again this morning, but I don't want really to dwell on that because Honourable Prince Buthelezi is here today, so that we give you your time and space to. We normally call members to convince us, to motivate. Yes. So we will give the Honourable Prince time to motivate, to convince the committee that we should say yes to the proposal. After that, we will ask the departments which are here to make an input. Normally it comes in the form of advising the committee. They don't instruct us what to do, just listen to them about whatever advice they may have on the issue. And I need to indicate at this stage that last week we had invited Treasury because if we say yes to the bill, a whole machinery around the proposed Prime Minister would have cost implications. So we invited them. We also had invited the Department of Justice because this is a constitutional change proposal. They are here also today. We had also invited Public Service and Administration. They were here last week, but Public Service and Administration are not here today. They were sending Ulrich. Is Ulrich here? Works in the presidency. Maybe he will still come because yesterday he had indicated that he would attend on their behalf. But he's also is a liaison between public service and Mosenake Commission as well as the presidency. But he is posted in the presidency. It looks like he is late. Lesetsa Khanyego, the DG of Treasury, is abroad. The deputy is also engaged. They have sent a letter to say that they will support us from a distance in this matter by communication. They will not be sending people physically to the meeting today. Justice is here. Is it Dr. Labusakhne? Are you doctor or master? Mister. Okay, thanks. Representing the Department of Justice, seconded by the Director General of Justice. Yes. So, looks like at this juncture you're the only departmental official, not unless I'm missing somebody, who is here. So, we will take this matter like this I propose today. We'll open space for Honourable Buthelezi to motivate his bill. Then we will open for the invitees, Department of Justice. They whispered something into my ear, which I said they must say to the meeting so that we put it on record. And then at that point, I will also put a treasurer's submission, which is in writing, before the committee. Then we will briefly deliberate as a committee in the presence of the Honorable Buthelezi, if he has time. But if he doesn't have time, okay, thanks. Next Tuesday, we will be meeting as a committee to finalize this matter. We will take a lot of time, and normally we meet 1 to 2, but I don't foresee that we will be done by 2 o'clock. So I have asked special permission for the committee to be allowed to have a parallel sitting with the House so that we give due attention to the matter, so that we don't just steamroll it in 1 hour's time next week. By the end of next week, Tuesday, there should be an indication as to what the committee says about the matter. We would have also received a substantial written submission from other government departments. We are awaiting Director General in the presidency. We have written to them several times. They have not yet responded. Do you have any information from them? There is a mess in the president's office. We've been trying to get hold of them for the last week. We wrote emails, we hand-delivered letters, we phoned the DG on his cell phone. They all claim that they don't know about this. So there is a mess in that office of communication. Yes. So I'll be failing in my duties if I don't report this to the committee. Yes, thanks. And this is not a judgment on the president. It's a judgment on the staff employed in the presidency. So it's them, it's where the problem lies. So I don't want the media to write like we said that there is a problem in the office of the president, referring to the president. We are referring to the personnel in that office supporting the president. They've given us total nightmares. And so much so that we resorted to phoning the DG on the cell phone. And that's not proper communication because you don't record that conversation. And that was late last night. Everything had failed, including this morning, a call was made again. On this note, if members, do you agree with the approach that I'm proposing? Any preliminary comments from the members before we take off? Mr. Mshululu?
I think it was good of you to have outlined the procedure because we usually do that in terms of misinterpretations as well as, of course, to clarify in terms of how we take decisions. And also, we always assume that a repeat of this has assisted, believing that even members who come from the party where the prince is did communicate to him on the very first day. And I'm saying this also in the presence of the DA, because we mentioned, and I must endorse our appreciation in terms of responses. We said whenever a senior member in a party proposes something, we always acknowledge. But on the other hand, in terms of consistencies, and we quoted the Honorable Tony Leon at some stage also, that we had to insist that we do not deviate from policy or practice. And I must say that for record, that he also, if you remember well, that he had to adhere because he didn't want to set a precedent in terms of the institution of constitutional policy. So we acknowledge that because some people would have thought that we would have deviated. And I'm just quoting that for record, that we appreciate, and I'm saying this also in the presence of the PA, and I believe you are in order. Thank you.
Always, we appreciate Prince Buthelezi's appearance before the committee. We sincerely appreciate
it. Oh, I said it, and then I prepared to
okay.
Thank you.
But also to say that we had asked research to do a comparative analysis for us of emerging democracies, advanced democracies, and African countries where there is a prime minister policy. So later during the after the chief or the prince have motivated, we'll open space for government departments that will be here by now, including the researcher, to take us just 3 minutes through that comparative analysis. But we had also said that we must go and check for us what were the debates, if any, around this matter at the World Trade Center, if anything. So I don't know if you didn't get anything. Okay, so we'll just give you 3 to 5 minutes to take us through the comparative analysis of the role of the Prime Minister vis-à-vis the role of the President or whatever, head of state, in those 3 categories of settings. Thanks. At this point, I will hand over to the Honourable Prince, and thank you once more for putting this matter, which is of critical importance, before Parliament. Thank you.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Honourable members, at the outset, I must reiterate publicly the apologies I've already tendered in a letter I wrote to the Honourable Chairperson of this committee for my failure to attend last week's meeting on account of my caucus having failed to inform me about it. In that letter, I also wholeheartedly thank the Honourable Chairperson for her kindness shown in accommodating me by giving me the second opportunity today, and I wish now to reiterate my heartfelt appreciation. And I regard being asked to appear before the committee as a privilege and an honor. Before entering the merits of my presentation, I wish to premise my remarks by explaining why I tabled a fully fleshed bill rather than a mere memorandum explaining the scope and objective of the intended bill. Our rules provide for a two-step process in terms of which this committee, after consultation with the relevant portfolio committee, votes on the desirability of what is effectively a notional legislative initiative, which still has no details. Then, through the office of the Speaker, the matter is referred to the National Assembly for a vote on the desirability of such a notional legislative initiative, which, if found desirable, returns to this committee where, at the instance of the proposing member, is transformed into an actual bill. Now, in the subject matter under your consideration, honorable members, both good and evil are in the details. The notion of a parliamentary system with separate head of state and separate head of government has 4 centuries of successful experience, during which it has seen several adaptations and variations from the original Westminster system. Now, in my own eyes, some of such variations are less desirable than others, and therefore knowing exactly what it is that is being proposed is relevant in assessing the desirability of this legislative initiative. Hence, the fully drafted bill, which I presented to you. Moreover, from the reports that I received from last week's meetings, it seems that the debate has already tied specific features of the separation, rather, of the 2 offices of the head of state and of head of government to the desirability of this legislative initiative. For instance, concerns were expressed that the president would have merely ceremonial or titular functions, almost as if he or she were a symbolic figure. However, if one looks at the details of the draft bill I've submitted, it is clear that even though all executive powers are transferred to the Prime Minister, in my proposal, the President has very real and significant powers, some of which are politically charged, such as, for instance, the selection of the Prime Minister himself or herself. In a context in which there is no absolute majority in Parliament and a coalition is necessary, such power may significantly direct the course of future events. I could refer to other aspects of my draft bill, but I do not wish to overburden the simple point, that reference to details may guide a decision on the desirability of the notion but it's no more than that at this stage. Now, the other reason, honorable members, honorable chairperson, which prompted me to go through the substantial work of producing a fully-fledged bill, lies in the urgency of the matter. I launched this initiative when I spoke about it in the State of the Nation debate of 14 months ago, and the matter has been discussed in various NGOs and in the media. On the same basis as last week's, this committee was unavoidably drawn into discussing the specific features of this proposal, so has the debate in the rest of the country. Hence, we need a fully-fledged notion. There is ripeness, I think, and urgency to this debate, which must now be brought to its next stage. And I'm very encouraged by the remarks of the chairperson. If a proposal of this nature is to be implemented, it needs to be so before the next election, and therefore there is very little time left. I'm keenly aware that the matter is not in my hands, and that it will be for others to decide whether to take it further and at a pace in which this ought to be done. On my part, I wanted to be sure that I've done as much as I could to expedite the process. I'm not suggesting, Madam Chairperson and all members, that what Parliament may finally choose to adopt ought to have all the features which I've suggested. But listing all the features which ought to be considered in an operation of this nature, those who are to take the matter forward at least then have a checklist of issues on which they ought to apply their minds. I, for one, am comfortable that what I have put forward is in the best interest of the country. And together with my advisors, I have given years of thought to it. I've mainly selected solutions which have been tried and tested, because I do not think that our republic ought to take the risk of charting undiscovered lands at this critical time. It can do so by modifying the system, of course, once it has taken root, and once we have a better understanding of what in it which works and what does not work. For instance, Madam Chair, during the last week's debate, the suggestion emerged that the president ought to be elected by the people, which is a significant departure, of course, from the classic parliamentary systems. I regard all this as being inadvisable myself, because the election of the president would be politically charged and have the same themes as that of the political parties. Strong with a direct political mandate, the president would feel more prone and authorized to interfere in political and policy matters, which would prevent him from placing himself above party politics. Even under our present constitution, the president is not elected by the people. It would also be difficult to elect a president through a process which forces consensus on the basis of a two-thirds majority requirement. Even if one uses a two-tier election, the president could only benefit from a mandate of an absolute majority. While in parliament, through repeated elections, it is possible for the president to be elected with a broader majority, and only with an absolute majority if a broader majority cannot be achieved. Finally, Madam Chair, before I argue the desirability of this legislative initiative, I wish to clear the table of another red herring, if I may call it that. The parliamentary system of government comes in two variations of constitutional monarchies and parliamentary republics. Their structure is very similar, save for the fact that in the former, the head of state has a lifelong office and is chosen on the basis of hereditary rules, while in the latter, the head of state is elected in one form or another. In constitutional monarchies, the head of state may have powers which range from being merely symbolic to being significant and powerful. Therefore, for our purposes, we should not concern ourselves, I think, about whether reference is made to a constitutional monarchy or a parliamentary republic, as both systems are viable comparisons for our deliberations. It is more significant, I think, to find references in a context similar to ours, which is one characterized by a rigid constitution, which is the supreme law of the land. Madam Chair, I wish to commence my presentation of the merits of this legislative initiative with the point that separation of the office of the head of state and head of government strengthens our constitution and its democracy by adding an additional system of checks and balances. One of the functions of the president is that of being a guarantor of the constitution, not from a judicial point of viewpoint, but clearly from a political and institutional point of view. Now, the most silent aspect of this power expresses itself in the assent of laws. As it is now, when a president assents a law, he needs to perform a preliminary review of its constitutionality, which may lead to remanding the law to Parliament for further consideration. I think President Mandela utilized this power on a couple of occasions, but it is a difficult power to exercise when the bill in question is produced and taken through Parliament by the very same government which the President presides over when he's also the head of government. Now, throughout the world, the parliamentary system is the most prevalent, and in its most classic form, is implemented in countries such as Canada, Spain, Portugal, United Kingdom, Ireland, Belgium, Germany, Poland, Austria, the Czech Republic, Slovak Republic, Italy, Sweden, Norway, Denmark, Finland, Netherlands, Turkey, Greece, Macedonia, Bosnia-Herzegovina, Iraq, Israel, Somalia, India, Pakistan, Bangladesh, Thailand, Malaysia, Cambodia, Japan, Indonesia, New Zealand, just to mention a few. In South Africa, we have a tradition of separation between the head of state and that of government. That was the case until 1983. At the World Trade Center negotiations, I suggested that it be maintained because it best serves democracy and strengthens the republic. I do not think that the matter was sufficiently considered there, where the prevailing concern at that time was that of breaking away from the past and empowering a president who could be the symbol of our victory, of our apartheid and liberation personified. As our democracy grows, we need to depersonify our institutional life so that the strength of our institution may make up for any flaw which its incumbents may have. Like in other countries, South Africa will have some presidents and prime ministers or ministers who are better than others. And our republic must remain strong even when the incumbents are weak. Throughout the world and history, great evil has befallen on democratic and peaceful nations, whenever greater reliance was placed on people in power than on the strength of the offices they served. It is for this reason that I look on this initiative as having nothing to do with my party politics, if I may emphasize. I have not introduced this on behalf of my political party, nor have I asked my political party to endorse it. There's nothing to do with them. There is nothing in it for me, Mangosuthu Buthelezi, or for my party, the IFP. I've introduced it as a concerned South African who has spent 60 years of his life studying, reflecting, and suffering in internal turmoil over the fundamental quest on how to create a system of government which will support democracy and our social and economic progress. I never doubted that liberation would one day come, even though I was not sure whether it would be in my lifetime. But I never achieved the same certainty that our liberation would enshrine a long-lasting democracy, which in turn can deliver freedom and prosperity for all. The latter, of course, is a much greater challenge which requires greater energies than that which we spend in our liberation struggle. There are too many examples, Honorable Chairperson, Honorable Members, where the hopes of liberation were betrayed by an unsuccessful system of government. Because of these enormous challenges ahead, the office of the head of government will have to bear increasing pressure, tensions, and controversies. It is going to be the lightning rod, in other words, of the foreseeable season of storms, which our republic will have to endure. Our social problems are enormous and cannot be addressed without controversies, or in a manner which will satisfy everyone at all times. An effective head of government will need to have the strength and institutional latitude to be unpopular at times. If he or she also carries the office of head of state, whatever turmoil affects the government of the day, it will engulf the whole of the republic, discrediting our entire system of government in the eyes of our people. Even at the worst of times, it is important that people have a reference in an office and in a person who can be detached from the troubles of the day and the heat of political controversy. Furthermore, a society sailing through the turmoil of divisions may benefit from a reference point who is above parties and is trusted and respected by all. And I can say that in many respects, former President Nelson Mandela and other leaders have performed such a role in the first core of our republic. However, It is important that such role be now institutionalized. It can be noted that South Africa always had a prime minister before, recently adopting the executive system, while after 1994 it benefited from a virtual separation between head of state and head of government. I hope you listen to me carefully here, because here are my weaknesses, each one of you. Maybe not to the same extent as myself. Although we adopted the executive presidency, the actual system worked as if there were separate heads of state and government. President Mandela rarely presided over cabinet. And Deputy President Mbeki presided over most cabinet meetings and in fact conducted the day-to-day administration of the state. To the extent that President Mandela often jokingly remarked that he was merely the de jure president, while de facto president was His Excellency President Thabo Mbeki. We are all aware of that. And that gave room then to Mr. Mandela to attend to the complex work of consolidating reconciliation in our country, which perhaps he would not have achieved had he been acting as the head of government, which job was done by President Mbeki for him. Now, there are also fundamental functions which must carry the credibility of being performed above politics of the day and the conflicts of the season, such as the appointment of constitutional justices and other office bearers of the institutions which support democracy. And by definition, all such institutions are called upon to play an antagonistic role to the government of the day by judging the constitutionality of the law or inquiring into the legality, efficiency, and appropriateness of government's actions and policies. For these institutions to be effective, they must not be the expression of and beholden to those whom they are called upon controlling and keeping under check and balance. There are plenty of examples, Honorable Chairperson, Honorable Members of Parliament and of this committee, certainly many in our own continent of Africa, where democracy has failed because those who were entrusted for their protection were too close and beholden to those who held the reins of government. Politics, as you know, all of us are politicians here. Politics moves in seasons. And it is important that the head of state and the head of government are not the expression of the same season. The term of the office of the head of state should not coincide with that of the legislature, which elected him, so that the head of state can be the bridge between one season and the next one. The impartiality and the strength of the head of state would be reinforced by providing him with a longer term and with the independence which comes from knowing that upon completion of that term, he cannot serve another term and cannot aspire for any other political office under the Republic, as we saw in Russia recently with Mr. Putin. The president should act not to secure his political future, but his role in history. Now, the value of parliamentary democracy as opposed to an executive system of government shows more clearly at a time of crisis and during extraordinary circumstances. For instance, when in 1976 the entire Spanish parliament and cabinet were kidnapped and held prisoner in parliament by a renegade group of soldiers, the head of state could mobilize the balance of the defense force to rescue the newly fledged Spanish democracy. And he did so without usurping or taking upon himself any power which he did not have under the Constitution. In fact, the role of a head of state is often described as becoming much stronger in the time of crisis. By virtue of the very function he exercises and inherent powers, and without resorting to extraordinary or emergency powers. Conversely, one can just wonder how many errors and evil deeds performed under the stewardship of executive presidencies could have been prevented had a parliamentary democracy been in place. One, for instance, thinks of the United States of America, ostensibly the most powerful democracy in the world, in which Congress did not have the resources or authority to question the presidential declaration of war against Iraq, made exclusively on the ground of Iraq holding weapons of mass destruction, which today remains like a figment of the imagination. In a parliamentary democracy, war would have been declared by the president rather than the prime minister, and perhaps the president would have taken a hard and critical look on the grounds on which war was meant to be waged. Many hours could be spent, honorable chairperson, honorable colleagues, members of parliament, me citing examples which support the proposition that with a parliamentary democracy, there is everything to gain and nothing to lose. Institutionally speaking, there is no loss in abandoning the executive presidency. In fact, in a parliamentary democracy, the prime minister himself is made stronger. For one thing, he is freed from a huge number of time-demanding commitments which force him to attend the due functions both in South Africa and abroad, which limit his capacity to deal with serious social and political issues of the day. One can think of how President Mbeki was criticized often for the sterling work which he did in launching NEPAD and the African Union on the ground that he did not sufficiently attend to the problems here at home. It was not very just. Secondly, by not being the head of state, the Prime Minister could be more forceful in taking political positions, antagonizing opponents, and generally speaking, getting the job done. No one would suggest that the German Chancellor, for instance, or the British, Italian, or Australian Prime Ministers are in any way weakened because of the presence of a separate head of state. If anything, the head of state covers their flanks and backs in many political and institutional respects in what becomes a silent partnership in governments. Admittedly, the overwhelming number of African democracies is based on an executive presidency. This may be the reason not to follow the trend and seek better solutions. For almost all executive presidencies, African executive presidencies, have highlighted problems and their democracies have suffered crises. Our present constitution has already not followed African trends in the hope to learn from mistakes made elsewhere, which is the advantage of our country being the last to achieve this liberation. And I tell you, President Mbeki used to tell me when I was in the cabinet very often how many people in Africa look up to us. So we should not turn our eyes and say we should look for examples in Africa, but they are looking up to us. The problem with most African countries has been that all powers have been centralized in one office held by one person. As often the rest of Africa looks up to South Africa to find solutions to its problems. In this respect, we may have the responsibility of leading rather than following. One could spend many hours, of course, on the subject, which has been covered by a plethora of books, and we could spend years to discuss it. In the end, as political leaders, we need to make a decision also with our guts. Under the present circumstances of our republic, and in the light of future foreseeable tensions and conflicts, I think most members of our parliament will feel it in their guts that what is before us is eminently desirable. For this reason, I plead with this committee to find my legislative initiative to be desirable and move it to its next day so that this important debate may continue. Madam Speaker, lastly, I wish my secretary to distribute questions and answers which I would like to go through with the members of the committee. If you can distribute those, please. But
just promoted me to speakership. Maybe it's the sign of good things to come.
I hope my dream comes true. On to the chairperson first, Mr. Some of the questions that may naturally come is, why is the president elected by parliament? And the answer is because if elected by the people, he or she would have a strong political mandate, potentially competing with the prime minister and prompting him to interfere in the policies of the day. We would need to run an election which would be divisive and which would echo the political platform of parties. Thirdly, could not be elected by 2/3 majority, and even if one resorts to a two-tier election system, he could only achieve an absolute majority. The two-tier election system operates when there are more than two contenders, and a second election is held between the two with the highest score in the first election. Then another question that may come naturally is, why is the president elected by the National Assembly only? Now, this is in line with the present schema of the Constitution, which leaves the responsibility of choosing the present president of the National Assembly only. However, one could also consider having the president elected by a joint sitting of parliament. However, the matter needs to be tied to the confirmation of the prime minister, which leans against the option, as you see below. Then another question comes naturally is, why is the prime minister not elected by people, but effectively chosen by parliament? The answer is because the parliamentary system strengthens parliament and promotes its centrality. This is already entrenched in our present constitution, which does not call for the president to be elected by the people. In this respect, our constitution provides for a hybrid between an executive and a parliamentary system, in that the president is not elected by the people. Another question, why does the prime minister need to be confirmed and can be removed both by the National Assembly and the NCOP? My answer is to strengthen the role of the NCOP and increase democracy. In a parliamentary system, the prime minister as head of government is accountable to the entire parliament as both chambers, even though the president is elected by upper chamber only. This is only because the PM, prime minister, can be elected by a simple majority, while the president's election requires at least an absolute majority. And the question is, the prime minister chosen by the president or parliament? The president chooses him, but can only choose the one whom parliament would choose anyway, or approve, because parliament needs to confirm it anyway. Whenever there is a clear parliamentary will, the president has no discretion, however. However, in time, rather, of crisis, when a coalition needs to be formed, the president has latitude to shape politics, which often may include several attempts before the right prime minister, backed by the right coalition, is accepted by parliament. Then another national question would be, is the president a purely ceremonial or titular figure?
I want to say from which quarter. I would beg that we allow the prime minister, the prince, to continue motivating until at least he finishes this set of documents before us, because we will have our own time on our own next Tuesday. So I would beg for patience. I wouldn't want a situation where we invite a member of parliament and then we deny them the time to motivate. Even if we end up not saying anything today, it's okay, we'll have our time on Tuesday. Although it would be nice if at quarter to 10 we can begin to round up. So I'm just begging for patience. I see two hands.
Chairperson, we are not impatient at all. In fact, we can continue speaking until 3 o'clock. We might not agree with him with some of the things, but he speaks very nicely.
Now, Chairperson, I think this approach I must share with you what I would have done later, exactly to say out of this presentation, we would then expect also the legal team, justice, and the relevant respond in the very same context in terms of your initial introductory remarks. So I think we are on course, we are in order. And they're really very patient, because this gives us, I wanted to thank you exactly for the introductory part. And I think it has addressed the face part, because the prince is referring to faces, and I think those are stages that assist the process in terms of engagement in the matter. Without it. So this ties directly with your introductory, as well as to give researchers an opportunity to respond to these matters, justice, even those who were the World Trade Center, who drafted the Constitution. So I think I'm
taking you, Ainsley, because we should not distract the flow of thinking of the Honorable Prince. I'll take you for 1 minute, and I'm not taking any other hand, so that we must not distract him too much.
I think you are misreading us. We are not impatient. We, in fact, very appreciative.
It's my staff that's impatient. You wanted me to say that.
I thought you were referring to us. we appreciate the extent to which Dr. Buthelezi has gone in his responses, and especially the tabling of the questions we raised last week. We haven't seen at this committee for a long time such devotion to work and to detail as we have today. So no, we appreciate, and I want to agree with the sentiments of my colleagues. If possible, we can go until late this afternoon, if necessary.
Just forced me to expose the two people sitting on both my sides. The ones, stand up. And then I was just saying, in case somebody else other than them shares the sentiment, I must just say that we'll have to be patient. Sorry, and thank you for indulging me and the committee for this brief commercial break, Honourable Prince. Thanks.
The president is here at the moment. The answer is no, he's not. He or she is not. Even though all the executive power are transferred to the Prime Minister, the President has a broad range of own powers, which exercises independently, such as those of assenting laws and performing a preliminary assessment of constitutionality, the long list of sensitive powers set out in Section 84.2 as adjusted by Clause 10. He has other powers which he must exercise in concert with other organs of state, such as the appointment of ambassadors, dissolving parliament, appointing certain constitutional court justices and members of the Judicial Service Commission and other officers of Chapter 9 institutions. There are also important requirements for the president to be consulted, as in the cases of declaring war or deploying the defense forces. Therefore, it is incorrect to suggest that the position of the president in terms of this draft bill would resemble the symbolic powers of the King of Lesotho or the ceremonial functions of King Zwelithini of the Kingdom of KwaZulu. In fact, if anything, it resembles the powers and functions of the heads of state of Germany, Spain, Italy, whose constitutional systems are very similar to ours, as they have regions or provinces and a lower chamber representing them. Then another question, why at times a power vests in the president, while in others it vests in the prime minister? My answer is that the executive function vests in the Prime Minister, save for when it is necessary to ensure that such functions are exercised not to follow the policies of the day, but to check and control them so as to protect the Constitution. Therefore, the President appoints the following officials after consultation with the Prime Minister, and as the case may be, the Judicial Services Commission or other relevant organ of state or leaders of political parties, the Public Protector, the Auditor General, members of the Judicial Commission, save for the four which are an executive prerogative, of course, members of the Public Service Commission, the Justice of the Constitutional Court, save for its Chief Justice and his deputy, whose appointments are more policy charged, in which respect the President still needs to be consulted. However, matters relating to the removal of such officers, which are often controversial, remain an executive prerogative. In other respects, the Prime Minister needs to consult the President before taking action, as when declaring a state of emergency, even though the Prime Minister and the President must concur before the defense forces are deployed. These elements are features of a comprehensive system of checks and balances. Then another question, is this type of parliamentary democracy consistent with the trend in Africa? Undoubtedly, the overwhelming number of African democracies is based on an executive presidency. This may be a reason not to follow that trend and seek better solutions. In the past half century of post-political experience in sub-Saharan Africa, almost all executive presidencies have highlighted major problems, and all such democracies have suffered major crises. Our present constitution has already, in many other respects, not followed trends present throughout Africa, exerting the hope to learn from the mistakes made elsewhere, which is the advantage of our country being the last to achieve its liberation. The problem with most African countries has been that all powers have been centralized in one office, held by one person. Often the rest of Africa looks up to South Africa to find a precedent to solve these problems. And also, in this respect, we may have the responsibility of leading rather than following. Then another question comes naturally, why opting for the British system over the French one? The answer is, as stated above, the direct election of the president does not achieve the desired result of having a head of state who is above party politics. The French system of cohabitation is a complex and peculiarly French one, which accounts for the fact that it has not been exported elsewhere in the world. It will be a major departure from our present constitutional schema and traditions, and is likely to create conflict if imported into our experience. Then another question, does the bill add real value as compared to the present executive presidents? I think very much so. As set out in the memorandum to the bill, the value of having a president and a prime minister is very significant in ordinary times and becomes enormous in times of crisis or turmoil. He strengthens our constitution and its democracy by adding an additional system of checks and balances. The controversies arising out of daily government, especially during difficult times, will not tarnish the presidency, while the prime minister will find himself to be stronger in dealing with them. The prime minister can have the institutional latitude to be unpopular at times without compromising the office of the head of state or discrediting our entire system of government in the eyes of our people. Even at the worst time, people will have a reference in an office and in a personal way who can be detached from the troubles of the day and be a symbol of unity. There are also fundamental functions which must carry the credibility of being performed above the politics of the day and the conflicts of the season, such as the appointment of constitutional justices and other office bearers of the institutions which support democracy. For these institutions to be effective, they must only not be the expression of and be held only for those whom they are called upon controlling and holding in check and balance. Moreover, as the term of office of the head of state does not coincide with that of the legislature, which elected him, the head of state can be a bridge between one political season and the next one. The value of parliamentary democracy as opposed to an executive system of government shows more clearly at times of crisis and during extraordinary circumstances. Because of his inherent powers, see section 84.1, the role of the head of state is stronger in the time of crisis by virtue of the very function he exercises and without resorting to extraordinary or emergency powers. The prime minister is also made stronger. He is free from time-demanding commitments in South Africa and abroad, which limit his capacity to deal with serious social and political issues of the day. Our country is facing enormous problems. By not being the head of state, he could be more forceful in taking political positions, antagonizing opponents, and getting the job done. Now, another question that comes naturally is, are there advantages to classic parliamentary democracy as opposed to an executive system? My answer is not really, compared to our present system. If one were to compare it to a classic executive presidency, there could be disadvantages if there is no certain parliamentary majority which could force votes of no confidence and various changes in the executive. But in any case, our constitution does not have a purely executive presidency and combines the problems of an executive presidency with those of a parliamentary system, in that the president could be voted out of office before the end of his term, as some were dreaming about it just now. The added disadvantage under our present constitution, when such a crisis occurs, there is no stewardship of the republic. And the firing of the head of state leaves the republic also without the head of state. Another question, what happens to the leader of government business? The position of leader of government business is not provided for in the present constitution and is not affected by the bill, therefore. Question, who deputizes the president as there is no deputy president? The need of deputizing the president in a parliamentary democracy is greatly reduced. It does not need to be deputized when he is abroad. Under our constitution, there is a contradiction, as when the president is abroad, there is an acting president in the country because of the need to have a head of government at home, with the consequence of having two presidents, as the president abroad needs to have his powers to act as a head of state, for instance, to sign treaties. To digress, Madam Chairperson, if you can allow me, I know that many people were troubled when I was acting as the president of this country, when I sent the Sadiq troops to Lesotho. Because the powers of a president in a parliamentary system do not regard the day-to-day running of government, there is a lesser need of deputizing in the case of illness or vacation. However, whenever such need arises, the functions are exercised by the chairperson of the Council of Provinces on the basis of a standard system of check and balances. Then the question, why the parliamentary system was not adopted at CODESA? Our present constitution has already gone a long way in adopting many of the features of the parliamentary system, and it is a hybrid, in fact, which has already greatly departed from the typical features of an executive presidency. At the World Trade Center negotiations, the matter was sufficiently considered because the prevailing concern was breaking away with the past and empowering a president who could be a symbol of our victory, of our party, and the liberation. And liberation itself personified. As our democracy grows, we need to deeper personify our institutional life so that the strength of our institution may compensate for the flaw which its incumbents may have. Another question, how does the function of a president as a guarantor of the constitution differ from that of a constitutional court of the Chapter 9 institution? answer is that the responsibility of guaranteeing and protecting the Constitution is spread across all organs of state. The President would be a guarantor of the Constitution, not from a judicial viewpoint, but from a political and institutional one. The most salient aspect of this power is that of assenting laws. When a President assents a law, he needs to perform a preliminary review of constitutionality, which may lead to sending back the law to Parliament for further consideration. It is a difficult power to exercise when the bill in question is produced and taken through Parliament by the very same government when the President presides over, when he is also the head of government. Moreover, the President is in a classic parliamentary democracy, has an additional inherent power, the power of admonition. Simply put, he is required to speak up and speak out when he sees something going wrong, not at the policy or political levels, but rather at the institutional level. This may include problems with the judiciary, parliament, or cabinet. The judiciary is barred from making such pronouncements. And if coming from any other institution, such as that pronouncement would be politically tainted. More importantly, in times of crisis, the powers of the President expand to address the emergency of the time through other organs of state. In terms of Section 84.1, the head of state has additional non-specified inherent powers. Now the question, will the President really be less beholden to the majority party? There are no guarantees, but only opportunities. A President elected with a broader majority and charged with a dignus and gravitas, which calls on him to be above what party's politics, may exercise a more independent role and not be a puppet of his party. After he left office, President Mandela surely achieved this goal. Furthermore, because he cannot be re-elected or hold other offices under the Republic, the President should be freer from the commands and dictates of those who elected him. You know, should not be held to ransom or expect, you know, marching orders from elsewhere. The question, what happens in the National Assembly if the National Assembly does not agree on a Prime Minister? The question, the answer is that the same as under the present Constitution. The previous Prime Minister serves until the next one takes office. That's the process of prorogation. If they want to get rid of the previous Prime Minister, the members of the National Assembly must find consensus on a new Prime Minister. Question, in real life, will the President of the majority party be a Prime Minister or the President? One cannot predict that with certainty. The future of politics, but it stands to reason that the President of the majority party will become the Prime Minister as he is one who governs the country. Question, why were Namibia and Mozambique not cited as examples of parliamentary democracies? Even though those two countries have prime ministers, the President is both head of state and head of government in those countries, and the Prime Minister merely assists and counsels the President in the conduct of government. Madam Speaker, I don't know what to say. Really, Boog.
It's sweet of you to speak in Sesotho, Honorable Sis, which is my language. Really, Boog, in Setswana. Thanks. Thank you very much. As I said last week, I said that you are known to be international, an astute orator, and also an astute writer, author. So thank you very much, in fact, for also answering so succinctly the questions we put last week. You have done very well, and you have answered all the important areas that we had posed questions around last week. If I may make preliminary comments and then hear out Justice. Justice, where is Mr. Labakuskakhna? Can you just tell them your role today here, so that it goes on record.
Thank you, Chairperson. The matter was discussed with the Minister for Justice and Constitutional Development. It was pointed out here that the proposals in the bill are very complex and it's a very difficult political issue. The Minister then advised that the Department should attend the meetings, but merely to observe the proceedings in the committee and then report back to the Minister on what is on the progress made in the committee. And that is as far as the Minister's order, the Minister's view at this point in time. Thank you, Chairperson.
I wanted you to pave the way for me to say that this is a complex, difficult political issue. which also will have to be informed. Parliament must exercise its role parliamentarily without fear or prejudice, whatever. But because it's also political, we may want to, not only political, it's also administrative, as Honorable Prince pointed out, even the NGO sector, civil society would be interested in this issue. So we have to handle it with a lot of care. For that reason, I want to start first on a light note and then make two preliminary comments, then open up for our researcher and then members. Did any other government department arrive? Not yet? Okay. Because we were expecting Ulrich, Mr. Ulrich, not yet. Okay. From a light point of view, Honorable Prince, thank you for sharing a state secret with us that Madiba used to say he is a de jure president and the de facto one is the now president, Meki. Secondly, it's not easy. You know, I always say, as a gender activist, I am an African woman too, raised in African norms and traditions. Even when I must raise gender matters, I calculate my space very carefully before the eyes of the elderly. So it's not easy for me to raise this matter because I always think that gender in South Africa and in Africa cannot be pushed like gender in Europe, where they don't have traditional consideration that we must have and that we must observe. So it is with a heavy heart that I raise this issue, that I notice that the Honorable Prince refers often to the President and Prime Minister as him and himself, especially on page 3. I'm raising this in a light note because I don't want to take the Honorable Prince hard on the matter because I'm an African child.
My apologies. I think it was a typographical error.
Okay. Thanks. However, Honorable Prince, there are two or three areas that I would like you to further clarify us on, but I also take members of the committee, including members of the IFP. I would invite you to note that the Honorable Prince says correctly that he did not ask his party to endorse this issue. So I expect you to participate as members of Parliament and air your views too. So don't feel constrained that it's your boss that is presiding, therefore maybe you should limit your participation. I'll open that way for you to participate freely. Honorable Prince, may I put three questions to you for clarity's sake? When we read the objects and the memorandum last week, it sounded like the President, in your proposal, must appoint the Prime Minister together with Parliament. Hence the argument of we also strengthened. But now I notice that in this document of questions and answers, it's only talking about your second question and answer. Why is the Prime Minister not elected by the people but effectively chosen by Parliament? Can you just clarify this matter? In your proposal, will the Prime Minister be appointed by the head of state or by the head of state together with Parliament? And whether Parliament cannot, for instance, then frustrate the head of state in appointing the Prime Minister if they co-appoint the Prime Minister. The other issue, you have correctly, you referred to a point that I don't know if it is somewhere in the memorandum, but I picked it up when you're presenting today, that somehow the term of election time of the president should not coincide with that one of Parliament. I want to check if I heard you properly. Maybe I did not hear you properly, so that you clarify yourself on that issue. You referred to the election of the president in line with the election for Parliament. And then the issues of declaring war in terms of your proposal, where declaring war is a very serious business. And it will also relate to calling for ceasefire. Who is it, the Prime Minister, or is it the President, or is it both of them who would declare war? And automatically it will also mean sign ceasefires, etc., etc. Now, my own personal observation, before I open for members, the researcher and members, the members will guide me whether I must take themselves first or the researcher first. Members first, okay. This is a very difficult and political issue, and the prince correctly says that it was elaborated on in World Trade Center during negotiations. I suspect that it may, because it was sealed there, there might be a lot of ground to be done. It's like the issue of, I don't want to draw an accurate parallel between the calls for capital punishment and this one, to say that some of the things that were sealed in CODESA, in some people's minds, are no-go areas, are written on stone. If you want to unwrite them from the stone or to delete them, you have to do a lot of work. So I somehow suspect that because this issue was agreed upon, or because our constitution took a shape it took after CODESA, it might be very, very difficult in the minds of many to revisit this issue. That's my own analysis. I hope I'm wrong. That because in CODESA, we did not agree on a prime ministerial position, it's going to be taboo or difficult for other people to reintroduce it after CODESA. The argument that CODESA deemed it not fit to have a prime minister, I suspect that it will prevail in this argument. But I would still, whilst I pause here, say to the prince, you must find joy in the fact that you raised this issue. Whether South Africa will agree to it right now or not, the fact that you raised it, I think, should count important, not only for yourself, but for the whole of South Africa, that you had introduced this discussion at this juncture, and whether at the end of the day, your proposal will see the light of day or not. I don't think that even if it doesn't see the light of day, it will be a total loss. The fact that you would have introduced it, for me, is still very much important, that you had the courage and you took the time and the space to raise these issues. And I will end here and take the members to hear them out. Mr. Ainsley, Mr. Magwanishe, Mr. Self. Okay. If you reply first.
Well, give me this question here, because otherwise.
Okay. All right.
I think I get my fingers to come and write them.
Okay. All right. No, it's okay. You may take them, Honorable Utilizzi, but then you will take a second round of the questions that come from members. Okay, that's okay. It's fine. Okay, let's just pause for the questions.
No, I think, Madam Chairperson, if we just look at the amendment, I mean, all of us have got copies of the draft. We've got amendment to Section 42. The National Assembly is elected to represent the people, ensure government by people under constitution, does this by electing the president and confirming the prime minister, by providing a national forum for public consideration of issues, by passing legislation, and by scrutinizing and overseeing executive action. And by then the National Council of Provinces represent the provinces to ensure that provincial interests are taken into account in the national sphere of government. It does this mainly by participating in the national legislative process, confirming the Prime Minister, and by providing a national forum for public consultation. Then I think we have the appointment of the Prime Minister itself, unfortunately, I didn't give pages to this, except that it's in section of 90A and section 90B in the Constitution of the Republic, towards the end of the, in the middle, appointment of Prime Minister. It's a new section that I'm proposing. That after the first sitting of the National Assembly, after its election, and whenever necessary to fill a vacancy, the President must appoint a woman or man from among the members of the National Assembly to be Prime Minister. When exercising the power referred in Section 1, the President may conduct consultation which must include the leader of the largest party as proposed in the National Assembly. The woman or man appointed in terms of Section 1 assumes the office of Prime Minister once confirmed by a resolution. Once confirmed by a resolution of the National Assembly and a resolution of the Council of Provinces. In other words, the President may appoint someone, but until that happens, that resolution, that person just remains, it's just a nominee until that resolution is passed. I think, Madam Speaker, I've answered the first part of your question. And then, concerning the the amendment of Section 201 of the Constitution of the Republic. For Section 201 of the Constitution, I propose that it be amended in this way. By substitution of the following subsection, that only the Prime Minister, in consultation with the President, may authorize the employment of a defense force in cooperation with the police service, defense of the Republic, and fulfillment of international obligations. By substitution of the subsection 3 of the following subsection, when the defense force is employed for any purpose mentioned in subsection 2, the Prime Minister must inform Parliament promptly and in appropriate detail of. In other words, there must be agreement between the President and the Prime Minister. And the Prime Minister must inform Parliament. I don't know if I've answered that. But as far as these things, I'm not resuscitating. I think that, of course, we must believe. I don't mean in this room. I mean, I'm talking to other South Africans that we must just believe each other that the development of events and the way things have turned out have actually convinced me that you know what I'm proposing is actually that the time is ripe for that, because all our members are aware of what has happened in our country recently, and these are not secrets, because even in Parliament, when all of you were present, I raised the issue of people forgetting that the head of state is the face of South Africa, and that therefore, being the face of South Africa, anyone you know, insulting such a person is in fact insulting us as citizens of the country, and so on. I mean, the developments that have taken place, which I don't need to tease out, I think justify whatever was done at Cordesa, and I'm not really hankering after Cordesa when I do so, but I was mainly referring to the fact that at that time I did propose it, but I'm even more convinced now because of how things have developed that it is necessary to make this change in our constitution for the sake of the office, not for the sake of myself or other or any part, but the sake of all of us as Africans. Now the term, as I explained in my memorandum of making a proposal of 7 years, I did explain in my memorandum that is deliberately to make a breach, and it's something that is not actually just done, comes from my thumb. I mean, in many democracies where there's a presidency, that is the case. But in countries like Germany and so on, that is the case.
I was deliberately highlighting this issue, because because I know there will be issues of serious consideration when we sit alone next week Tuesday. So I preliminarily wanted to get your responses because I know they are going to be the sticky points. Yes. Thanks. Thank you very much. Mr. Ensley, Mr. Magwanishe, and Mr. Sell.
Yes, sir.
Honorable members.
Yes, sir. Thank you very much. The Speaker of the National Assembly has often said she wishes to extend the national debate. Now, I think we must thank Dr. Buthelezi. His proposal does just that. And whether we agree with Dr. Buthelezi or not, it does give us the opportunity for rigorous debate. Chairperson, I think the proposal makes a good case for a Prime Minister. But it does not make a good case, in my view, for what is wrong with the present system. We have an executive president who makes himself available to Parliament, he makes himself available to the National Assembly for vigorous and thorough questioning. We have a deputy president who's part of the House, who's also head of government business. We have a very good relationship between the presidency and Parliament. So I'm not too sure, I don't quite understand what is wrong with the present system. It seems to be working. Chair, in addition, many of these points have been raised over the last 17 years or longer. There was vigorous debate at Kadesa on these issues between the first democratic elections and the final constitution. All parties had countless is in diesel, rallies, public meetings, town hall meetings, village meetings, report back meetings, where this very issue was discussed and thoroughly examined. It was thoroughly examined with outside inputs at Parliament before the final constitution was signed, and shared at every level. There was widespread consensus for the current system we have. And so I ask, are there any new facts which were not available to Kadesa, which were not available to the Izimbizo, which were not available to Parliament, that we should not take into account if we consider this drastic change to the Constitution? Chairperson, that is the only question I have to Dr. Buthelezi. But if you will allow me quickly, briefly, to ask the Department of Justice, when are we going to get their response? This matter has now been on the table, not for months, I think I may be right in saying for 2 years. When are we going to get their responses, their written responses to the proposal? Thank you.
The new facts, Honourable Lutheran says that the current issues that have happened in our country that is safe are not secret, convinces him even more that this bill, he's right, he was right to propose it. So it looks like those are the new circumstances or facts. Whether they are strong enough to ascend to the bid is another issue. But I think he has already pointed out to, but he will speak for himself when he answers members later. Mr. Magwanishe.
Thank you, Chairperson. I must say the Prince of Teles has made a very good argument for this issue of a Prime Minister. But I must also indicate that whatever views we express here will not be a reflection on him or on his argument. He has made very good arguments. But I think this is also an issue of a matter of choice, ultimately. You either choose this system or not choose this system. Because my initial response would also be there are problems also with the system that he is proposing. As much as there might be challenges with the executive president. For instance, you might have a situation where, because of personalities, you sometimes have tensions between prime ministers and president. And I think he would be aware that at some point towards the end of the Transkei government, there were those tensions between Kaiser Matanzima and his brother. Because of the president, most of his powers wasn't the power to appoint the prime minister. It's not actually a power that rests on him. It's a power that rests in him and Parliament. In most cases, what happens is that the President will appoint Prime Minister because the Prime Minister is the leader of the majority party and he has won elections. That party has won elections. So the issue is that there might also be tensions also with the system that he's proposing between the two offices, especially that the powers of the President are fewer and sometimes they depend on the personality of the individual there. That is what we found in the transcribe then. And the other issue that I would also want to raise, the President, is that national unity does not only depend on strengthening the executive. It depends on us strengthening all organs of state. And I think this is what our democracy has been trying to do. As the manner in which judges are appointed is open, is an open process. People have got the right to input. The appointment of other institutions, most of our system, as Honorable Ensley has alluded to, that there is nothing that has been shown to be inherently wrong with our system. And our system was developing. I think it is too early to say our system is facing challenges that are insurmountable. We might, after some time, after having given a chance to our system and say that, no, our system is not able to respond to these issues. But as of now, I'm not convinced that our system of government is not able to respond to these issues. And the other, the last point.
We are under pressure because it's 10 o'clock and there's another meeting coming.
The last issue, Chairperson.
I'll take you 1 minute from Mr. Self, 1 minute from Mr. Shulu.
Okay. One issue that I would like to also put across is that this argument that Honorable Taylor has alluded to, they can be done, they were done, even according to him, in the current system during the time of President Mandela and President Mbeki. So there's nothing that they're not provided for. So they can be done even within the current system.
1 minute, 1 minute, and then we'll go back to Honorable Buthelezi, then I will close the meeting. Mr. Self, Mr. Mtsululu.
Chair, thank you very much indeed for the opportunity, but I can't make the point that I wanted to make in 1 minute. I think it would be disrespectful to the proposal, so I'll make the point next Tuesday.
I'll give you 2 minutes then.
No, well, even within 2 minutes. There's a substantial...
Look, you can still make the key points.
All right, let me just ask one small question of clarity, really, because I think this is a very big debate, and I would share the view that it's an extremely important debate which we take very, very seriously. And I would echo the compliments that my colleagues have paid to the work that the Prince has put into this, because I think it is something that we need to grapple with. I had some views about the process, but I'll keep those for another occasion. Just like to ask, in the introduction to this, Dr. Buthelezi referred to the 4 centuries of growth of the institution of Prime Minister, which is really a institution where powers were clawed away from the traditional head of state. And those heads of state still have residual or inherent powers. Now, one of the great advantages of our constitution is it defines the powers in very explicit terms of the head of state, as opposed to relying on this rather more vague residual or inherent powers. Does, is there not an argument that could be made that if you leave these things vague, that they can in fact be abused as they were indeed in the past?
You wanted us to lose that important question, Mr. Self. No, your question is noted, Mr. Mshudulu.
But just my comment, Chairperson, is to put on record that really there is a need for the presidency to respond to in writing as well as justice. Much as we would like to, I think the introductory, the introduction of Honorable Buthelezi today has focused on the desirability, despite the the legislative proposal which we responded on. We would like to hear exactly in terms of the constitutionality of, from the presidency as well as justice, line by line. I'm saying on the bill now, so that we other issues shall be dealt with by the research union. Thank you.
I sent the researcher out to keep the door for us, but he has circulated, and I hope the prince also received a copy, of a preliminary research that juxtaposes, in fact, extracts the Canadian model and others for us. Now, Honorable Buteles, between now and Tuesday, myself and you, whether I keep touch with your honorable self or not, feel free to communicate. To even when we will be in a committee mode alone on Tuesday, we are not closing door on your further input, whether they will be written or whatever. So the invitation is still open. IFP members, I have indicated that you may participate. You chose not to take your chance, so I'll give the honorable Buteles time to make his final remarks, if you're not going to say anything.
No, Madam Chair, we have been, obviously, you would have noticed from the questions, we've taken it all from the previous week and we've communicated it with the Honourable Prince, and that's why he had been able to respond directly to those. So we won't have any questions or take any of your time. Thank you.
He who eats last eats best, Honourable Prince. It's your chance.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I just want to make this very clear to all my colleagues that this is a notion. It's a notional initiative which I'm put in good faith. And the bill, the draft that I've put is a draft. The name of itself says it's a draft, which means that Parliament can do what it likes with it. You know, so as far as this question, like Mr. Ainsley saying that there's nothing wrong, I'm really surprised. You know. I didn't want, you know, actually to be more blunt about some of the things that have happened that have convinced me that there's need for this division. The manner in which, for instance, our president was treated at a function where I was present in Durban, when Dr. Singh, the Prime Minister of India, visited this country, where he was abused in public, and other things that have happened since then. For me, as a South African citizen, not as IFP member, it's something that I feel insults me as a citizen, that the head of state of my country, you know, who is the face of my country, should be treated in the manner in which he was treated. To say there's nothing wrong, there's nothing wrong with it, and so on. I don't know. I'm just expanding the debate. That's all. I'm not trying to impose anything. I realize that I come from a minority party, but I still have a conscience, and I think as a sovereign citizen, as a legislator, which is the name of an MP, I have a right to put before this country what I think is called for by the circumstances in which are coming, the storms that we see, which can tear this country apart. Okay? They should not be downplayed. They are very serious problems. Now, and as far as Mogadishu, just to make the isolated example of Transkei, I don't think that, in spite of all the examples that I have given all over the world, I don't know where nothing like that arose. If it arose in the Transkei, they say that solely because it happened in the Transkei, in spite of all the countries that I've quoted in my presentation, where this has worked, I don't know. That's a matter of opinion. I think that's purely a matter of opinion. Now, as far as the question of Mr. Self is concerned, I think that we have a constitution And I think that in the draft constitution, I don't think that there is anyone who can operate in our country outside the four corners of the constitution. And I made an example of what happened in Spain, for instance, where the president of Spain saved the country when some renegades invaded with a certain section of the army, tore Spain apart. As an example that I present, where in fact I think those inherent powers of the president of the country assisted. Now, when he says that if he dictates, I don't know where Mr. Self will be when he dictates. I think there we are watchdogs ourselves as members of parliament. I don't think that even the present executive dictates, because he and I belong to political parties, opposition political parties, and there's nothing that we do not query or question. So the question really, I don't know, I don't understand the question in the light of what I'm saying now. Because, I mean, we are there as watchdogs. I don't think that we would allow, whoever it is to do anything that is actually unlawful or which is undemocratic, etc. So I can't see how that can arise. Because, of course, he has the right to speculate that human beings, as I say, some prime ministers are good, some presidents are good, some are not. But I think the system makes up, in that it's institutional, in that regardless of how those various persons, incumbents are, it makes up for that, because if the institution is correctly set up, it makes up for weaknesses of whoever is an incumbent.
Thanks, Honorable Prince. There is a lot of pressure from here. I received 10 notes from agitated people outside there, and I extend my apology to them through the system, but we could not just conclude in a haphazard way. And Honorable Self, will you forward other questions that you might have to Honorable Buthelezi so that they reach him and he responds before Tuesday? Then you can table whatever responses you got before the committee on Tuesday. On this note, I thank you, Honorable Members. ANC members, we'll have to meet in a study group on Tuesday. We will be in communication with you. Thanks. Bye-bye.